Andy, my dude, have you heard of the magical website builder known as Squarespace?
Ugh, not another Squarespace ad. I feel like every podcast is sponsored by them.
Hey, don't knock it till you try it. Yes, okay, it is overhyped, but actually it lives up to the hype. Squarespace is like a website fairy godmother. With a click of a button, your site transforms into a beautiful masterpiece.
A website fairy godmother? That sounds interesting. What makes it so magical?
Well, for starters, those slick templates make anyone look like a professional web designer. Pick one, customize the colors and fonts to match your brand, and voila. Plus, the drag-and-drop fluid engine is so easy, your grandma could build a site on Squarespace.
Well, she did knit me a lovely scarf last Christmas. Maybe website design is next.
Exactly. And when you're ready to sell your Nana's handmade scarves online, Squarespace has built-in e-commerce. Add a store with one click, get flexible payment options, then watch those sales roll in. And when she wants to teach others her steezy scarf skills, Squarespace's new courses feature is just the ticket. Nana can set up her curriculum and enrollments and payments in a snap and become the next e-knitting influencer.
Ugh, wow, you really sold me with the grandma angle. Sign me up for that free trial.
Just go to thenextreel.com/Squarespace and transform your site into a beautiful Squarespace masterpiece.
Well, thanks, Pete. Even though it's overhyped, Squarespace actually sounds perfect for Nana's site's needs. Appreciate the warning on the ads, though. I'll brace myself next time I listen to a podcast.
Anytime. Let me know if you need any help getting that site up and running.
Welcome to CinemaScope, where we shine a light on the shadows of cinema's genre landscapes. I'm Andy Nelson, your guide on this journey to bridge film genres, subgenres, and movements, ultimately deepening our understanding of them all. Today, for our second episode, we're digging back into early film history to look at German Expressionism, to discover the roots of this influential movement that would go on to shape the world of cinema for decades to come. We'll explore the distorted sets, high contrast lighting, and psychological themes that define this groundbreaking style and trace its impact on everything from film noir to modern horror. Join us as we uncover the secrets of this pivotal moment in cinema history. I have two fantastic guests joining me today. It's going to be a lot of fun talking with these two about this. Dr. Ian Roberts, hello.
Hello there.
And Ken Danziger, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you.
I'm thrilled to talk about this with both of you. Before we jump into the conversation, let's hear a little bit about each of you and kind of how you came to German Expressionism. You both teach, and there's a lot of German Expressionism in the stuff you teach and write about and everything. So, Ian, let's start with you.
In a sense, I have to confess that initially, at least, I came to Weimar cinema almost by accident, in as much as my PhD and my early career was dominated by the fiction of the post-Second World War West Germany. And for a while, when I was kind of struggling to get my first academic post, I thought I might have to reinvent myself a little bit. I'd always enjoyed film in the broader sense of the word. And almost despite myself, as I started to watch some of the Weimar classics, found that I was just getting sucked into them. Once I then started on my teaching career, both from a personal point of view, really enjoying the films themselves, the themes that were on the screen, the way they reflected aspects of life and society in their day, but also as the years have gone by, what's really struck me is how those films still shed light on our own society and our modern times, and how successive generations of my students have woken up to that reality too, means that now, sort of 25 years later, I'm finding the films fresher than ever and really enjoying, again, personally watching them myself and still exploring them, but also sharing them with each successive generation of students. So I think they're terrific films. I think it's a really exciting topic, and I'm really thrilled to be talking about it today.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you're here. Ken, how about you?
I started out making films, and somehow I was always pitched a teaching job, and of course, to pay for work as a writer or director, you needed a job. And so, and I had always been what I would call a fanatic about movies. And so I would say if I've spent the time since, a fairly long time, exploring storytelling. And storytelling from the point of view of the writer, the director, and the editor. And I've written a number of books about these. And I've always viewed my teaching as a kind of laboratory to explore these three areas. And expressionism, very early, you know, I was a student in Boston. I would go, while I was a student, every night to a different cinematheque and see movies. And so over the 3 years I was there, I saw everything. I saw more than 1,000 films. And what I was struck by in the expressionism is their darkness, their technical strategies, and how they really provide us with a foundation for modern filmmaking, because they used studio production as opposed to going to Monument Valley or part of Hollywood to film. And people like Hitchcock went to Germany to look at expressionist production strategies, and they're profoundly influential on his career. People like Murnau, the way he used the moving camera, Fritz Lang, the way he used sound. It was all so creative. It was wildly creative. So I found the period very rich, and it's always been foundational in my writing. So I'm happy to be here with both of you and talking about this very exciting, formative advance in film.
Well, and that's, you know, I'm glad that you both kind of spoke to that, because that's definitely an element that gave me reason to want this particular movement early in the conversation of that I'm going to be having across this show, because it is such a formative film movement that created very early in the kind of toward that birth of cinema, like right toward the beginning. But it's also one that is very particularly like windowed in this period of Weimar cinema, this period in German history, because of like what was going on then. And so it's amazing to me how widespread its fingers kind of wove through cinema afterward. And so for that reason, I really wanted to make sure that I was talking about this early. Before we really jump into kind of the history and everything, for people who are tuning in who, like, they've heard German Expressionism, I mean, probably some people out there have heard German Expressionism as a term in the art world. They may not be familiar with it in the world of film. How would you just simply describe to somebody, like, what is German Expressionism?
Well, I think from a scholarship point of view, it's a really interesting question, because that's a question that's still being debated even today. As you say, the fine art movement and the theatrical movement of Expressionism effectively died during the course of World War One. Indeed, many of its exponents were killed in action. And then this kind of renaissance of the movement in the early 1920s is still open to debate about the extent to which every film from this period might even be called expressionist. A very influential critic from the 70s, Barry Salt, depending on even his own sort of shifting interpretations, is prepared to accept a maximum of 7 films which you can say are truly expressionist.
Wow.
of
very
which,
tiny movement.
Yeah, well, precisely. Of which then he would have claimed the others were expressionistic. Mm. And then later in the period of the Weimar Republic, a new art movement called New Objectivity comes about, which is a much more realist-driven approach. But crucially, that tagline of expressionism, in a nutshell, is about mood. The German word is Stimmung, where the image is used to evoke emotion visually, very often using starkly contrasting light and dark. Again, the term that's often used here is chiaroscuro, which is a theatrical term meaning the play of light and darkness. And it's a period where a lot of what really interests us is on the border between what is light and what is dark, what is day and what is night, what is life and what is death. And these films, regardless of how many you might fit into that that category, these films play with quite fundamental aspects of the human psyche with that visual imagery, which makes it so rich for interpretation.
I find the period post D.W. Griffith entering the early 20s is a very experimental time. It's experimental in theater, it's experimental in the visual arts, and it's experimental in literature. To add to that, there's a feeling in Germany at the time of betrayal. There is not quite a civil war between the German army and the nascent communist movement. There's assassinations, and there's a general instability in Germany around the economy and the politics and this sense of live life in the moment, because tomorrow you may be bankrupt or you may be dead, etc. And so the notion of life being so vulnerable emanates in everything in Weimar Germany in the 20s. And I would say psychoanalysis as an explanation at one end and John Maynard Keynes as an explanation at another end says this is a period of ferment, and the creative ferment expressed itself in these films, beginning with Caligari. So, you know, it's a period that's rich in experimentation, particularly in film techniques.
I think Ken's point about the instability of the period is really quite illuminating. There seems to be a correlation between times of great upheaval in society and great creativity. And that's certainly true of the Weimar period. Film becomes, I've sometimes even termed it a new kind of battleground, as German people are trying to establish what kind of nation they want to be. The end of the First World War has seen the collapse of the monarchy. It's seen the establishment of, for the first time in Germany's history, because Germany is a very new country anyway, in 1919. And for the first time, you have something like a proper democratic form of government. And out of all this comes this huge wave of creativity, which both reflects many of the issues and the societal movements that are going on in the period, but also then in turn also seem to shape some of the developments that come about. You know, there was a time when if we showed students a picture of Spanish influenza wards, because that blighted many countries in the last couple of years of the war and into the 1920s. And my students would be at least puzzled, if not, you know, quite repulsed by some of the images we saw. But now, of course, we're beginning to see similar kinds of upheaval in our recent past, where we've had the global pandemic. And so images of people wearing masks is not so strange. Equally, in the 1920s, both at the beginning of the decade and, of course, the Wall Street crash at the end of that decade sees, as Ken said, huge economic upheaval, which again, people kind of get these days. You know, most of the world is suffering from sort of economic crises of one kind or another these past few years. And then you have a really bitter struggle, politically speaking, for ascendancy and the right to determine the direction of a country as it emerges from some of these catastrophes and these periods of upheaval. And that just makes for this incredibly rich backdrop to the filmmaking.
I think one of the things, so talking kind of like that, the birth of this movement and everything, I mean, expressionism had as an art form had kind of been around before it kind of moved its way into film. Like, I think a lot of people who may not be familiar with German Expressionism in film, or at least the term, likely are familiar with, you know, Edvard Munch's The Scream. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, for many people, just kind of an iconic element of what they would think of as kind of expressionistic art.
Yeah.
And I think seeing that painting and then this movement, you can definitely see the parallels of like how that kind of moved into this.
Yes.
Was it all of this turmoil that was going on that kind of created that movement in the art world to begin with?
Well, I suppose the very origins of the art movement, you would have to say perhaps no in the first instance, because it comes in a period which was still relatively stable, sort of the period from 1900 to 1910, say. But you are beginning to see artists and playwrights especially trying to view the world differently. And a lot of fine art is about abstraction and distortion. A lot of the, sort of the jagged lines that we associate with the expressionist cinema movement, we're seeing in some of the paintings and fine art that's coming out of not just Germany, out of various European countries in the early 1900s. The expressionists believe that by distorting reality, they were able to catch a glimpse of something more fundamental, something which was beneath the surface, something which was essential, the German term. And so when you have the added trauma of the First World War, which at one level shattered many of the illusions of the original wave of expressionist painters and writers and thinkers, it clearly struck a chord with the early filmmakers that emerged in that first period, 1918, 1919, through to the early 20s. Added to that, at least according to some narratives from that time, was a rather more pragmatic sense that by simply painting kind of jagged backcloths and things, you could produce a film quite cheaply. At a time when hyperinflation meant that electricity, for example, was ruinously expensive. And so to light a film set in any way that you know, might be considered even today sort of the correct approach, that was proving a technical challenge at the time. So a number of factors seemed to come together in a kind of perfect storm of creative juices that bring about this first wave, which just captures everybody's imagination. I mean, Germany has a bad rep in 1918, and then these wildly experimental films in that first couple of years after the war actually attract global interest, and for many were seen to be kind of a first step towards rehabilitation as well. So it just works on so many levels.
Well, and it's, you know, Ken was saying, who, you know, we've unfortunately lost internet issues. Hopefully Ken will be able to rejoin us, but was talking about how this was a period of great play and creativity in film anyway. Like all of these early silent films, wherever they were being made, like you see such frivolity and experimentation in the tools that they had and the way that they were exploring. And, you know, the cameras were much smaller. They hadn't introduced sound yet, which suddenly makes these giant cameras, and it was a very different thing to have to wield when they were filming. And so they were able to really play, and you get some exciting movement, and like there's just a lot of joy that they're having. And yeah, in Germany, like you're talking about kind of the lower budgets and everything that they were working with, and so using these stylized sets to kind of create a mood without having to build this fantastical world, I think is a great point just to how they were accomplishing a lot with not necessarily having to spend as much and doing it on stages where, you know, they didn't have to go out into location and everything.
I mean, to be fair, that changes, obviously, as time goes by. You know, by the time you get to the mid-20s, some of the sets for, say, Fritz Lang's Nibelungen are fantastic creations built within these big sort of Zeppelin sheds left over from the war. But it's that early period of kind of crisis and innovation which marks the whole decade plus of filmmaking until the rise of the Nazis. Yeah.
And they would start going out on location too with, you know, some of the films that we'll be talking about both in the first part of a show. And then for our member bonus content, we'll be having some additional ones and some like crossovers. Like there's a mountain film that we'll be talking about that. I mean, they're filming that out on location in the Alps. It's just like some beautiful filming that they're accomplishing.
And hugely dangerous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Some of that stuff, I'm like, well, that looks like a real person hanging off a cliff right here. Yep. Yeah. Some crazy stuff. Okay. When I first say German expressionist films, my brain always first goes to the look. You've already been talking about kind of like the painted sets that they would create, like this stylized visuals. You've got a lot of distorted looking elements in it, sharp angles, shadows. Sometimes the sets themselves, the design of them, it just seems not right. Like I'm thinking of in the cabinet of Dr. Caligari when they go into the police station and the desks are like incredibly high and the chairs also are high, but as high as the desk. So they almost have to like sit over the desk. Like it's just like kind of nonsense when you look at it, but it creates this thing in your head like something is wrong here. Like this is, these people are like looming over everyone who walks into their office. It's fascinating. So I think the looks, that's an incredibly important thing. But also, I think stepping away from that, I think you're getting into these characters where there's so much psychology that we have with them. We're really looking into the inner state of the people themselves and just kind of like this psychological viewpoint of the world. And I think that's a very important element, right?
Yeah, this is where the films as inheritors of the expressionist movement makes for this really nice kind of flowing development of artistic expression in this period, because the expressionists were already experimenting with this idea of digging beneath the surface, of getting to a deeper understanding of the human psyche. And so that visual carries into the Weimar films, but then so do the themes. It's all about exploring what it is that makes us tick, and, you know, themes of love and jealousy and hatred and revenge and control or freedom. You know, these are meaty subjects, which in the first instance, you might imagine wouldn't work as themes for film. But the creative talent of these teams in the period means that they can come up with plot lines that develop these themes in a way which is really accessible to audiences. Both, you know, the evidence would suggest they were, on the whole, the ones that we know about, very popular in that day, but have certainly remained popular in that sense ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken, welcome back to the show. Sorry about your internet troubles. That's never a fun thing to have to deal with. But we were just talking about kind of like this psychological element that is in these stories and the darker side of the characters. Do you have anything you'd like to speak to about that?
So the themes of despair, poverty, self-image, station in life, male-female relationships, jealousy, envy, sensual desire, all of these were subject matter, as was criminality, pedophilia, and M, and so on. So prostitution quite often in the films like Joyless Street. So the issues of psychology are very prominent, and the difficulties of the individual in the midst of these challenges is the subject matter so often of the films.
That speaks to a lot of what I, especially like the films that we're talking about. I see that a lot across this whole, the breadth of the stories. I want to talk a little bit more about it, but I want to use the first film that we're going to be talking about just to kind of like start illustrating some of the points that we're making here. We're over the course of this discussion, we're going to be talking about five films: The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Street, The Last Laugh, Pandora's Box, and M. We'll talk about five others in our member bonus content afterward, but just to kind of really kick things off, I want to jump into The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari because it is such a a critical film that really kind of was right at the beginning of this movement that really set the bar for kind of what people expect. My hunch is, Ian, that this is one of those seven on that person's list of films
very
that are 100% German expressionist. Let's kind of discuss a little bit about that. This is one, Ian, that you were talking about, like the sets. It's all painted backdrops. They didn't probably have the budget to kind of build all of this. The thing that really struck me on this rewatch of it, there's a staircase in the film that has this fantastic, it's very dark, but it has a fantastic bit of light, like streaking across, like kind of going all the way up. And on this watch, I really was able to notice that, oh, that's just painted onto the stairs. There's not a light doing that, because when the actors walk up and down it, they're casting a completely different shadow. It's very fun to kind of pick up on those elements. But that being said, it still creates an incredible mood just looking at like some of these elements within the set. Are there particular elements in the set design that kind of really stand out as like, this is a good example of what you see in German expressionism, particularly, I suppose, as we can talk about how it relates to our character's mental state?
The element to which that painted light plays into much of what we're going to talk about today, with this tension between light and darkness and how that reflects on the human condition. We see that in spades with Caligari. Again, there's a little bit of a debate about the reason why it was done. I mean, the common explanation is simply that it was a way to save some money. Erich Pommer, who's the producer, and actually goes on to be the producer for so many of the key films in our period, he claimed from the very beginning that for him, the relative inexpense of the production was what really mattered. But I think from our point of view, regardless of the truth or otherwise of why they painted the sets the way they did, is that they both reflect this sense of chaos, internal chaos, which is externalized, a world which doesn't seem to quite add up. And what a lot of viewers don't quite realize the very first time they watch Caligari, at least, is that actually not all the film is shot that way. There is what we call a frame story wrapped around the main film, where in fact we don't have that set design. And so it's quite clear that whenever we are looking at the main part of the film, where all these jagged designs are confusing our eye, is that that's because that's a reflection of the confusion of the central character, Francis. What of his experience is real and what is a figment of his imagination? And that's where the film is just wonderful for unpacking that sense of how sometimes the harder we try, the less we can make sense of the world around us. And towards the end, although really it's the central moment, a lot of these painted lines and play on light and shadow come together to a single focal point in the courtyard of the insane asylum, where at one point we think that Francis as the hero is about to unmask the evil doctor, and then it transpires, or does it, that in fact he is simply an inmate of this asylum and the doctor is trying to cure him. And that becomes this wonderful play on this period when the film is being released about madness, authority, the Conrad Veidt character, Caesar, this sleepwalking somnambulist who is this automaton killing at the behest of his master, which has been read by many as a metaphor for the First World War itself. People are just confused in this period. Ken mentioned it too. People just don't know where they stand in society and where the society is going. And have they put the evils of the past behind them? Or my reading is very much that all the kind of, there are lots of images of cycle and literally revolution in the film as well. You know, is it in fact that these evil days could come back if we're not on our guard? So it just becomes this wonderfully psychological deep dive into somebody's mind and wondering whether life, any part of life, is real or not, which is so fabulous about it.
the story is, as you were talking about, we kind of get this framing device, and then we jump into the story where we have this hypnotist, Dr. Caligari, who keeps this somnambulist in a cabinet, as we have in the title, who is murdering people in this community. But then it's woven into this framing device, this overarching story that leaves us with this twist at the end of, like, is this guy really just crazy? It's questioning the nature of reality. There's a lot of, we were talking earlier about the police desks and how high they are, and like it gives this air of like this overwhelming authority in the movie, but perhaps also in society. Ken, do you want to speak to what we're talking about here and how there's this like this surreal world that we're in, but it also is kind of creating this unease by the way that it's telling this story?
Essentially, the counterpoint to this would be a realistic approach to a visit to a madhouse. Now, the idea of non-naturalism or expressionistic or exaggerated portrayal of an environment takes us to interpretive different levels, to madness, to the inner world, to the world of superstition, paranoia, fear, and in a way, set design to create a feeling of that inner world is, to my mind, the real achievement here. You know, the painting, the irregular shapes, the lines, the exaggeration in the set design takes us to seek an alternative meaning than naturalism. And so we're often running in a kind of pictorial madhouse and trying to interpret it, get what the filmmaker is taking us to. And I think it's, as Ian says, it's a kind of portrayal of feeling at the end of the war, chaos, loss, instability. And here, set design and pictorialization is taking us into that feeling of unsteadiness about the world.
It's a fascinating way to tell a story. It's fun. I mean, it's kind of just a brilliant film in the way that it weaves this tale to really kind of paint a picture of this broken man as we kind of come to the end, and we're like, we're getting this sense of, oh, was he the crazy one all along and he's in this institution and everything? Or, as you said, Ian, or is he? Like, where are we in all of this? Like, it doesn't leave you with necessarily a sense of feeling settled at the end. And that's, I think, such an interesting element of this film, of this period, of the movement of history, you know, and I find that so interesting about it.
Even the opening scene where we see Caligari for the very first time, he's shot against the background of a fairground carousel.
Yeah.
And that says from the very beginning, nothing's going to make sense. It's going to be in constant motion. Every time you think you've made up your mind, something else comes around to change the way you feel about what's being portrayed. And that's just a wonderful device for setting the tone.
Yeah. It's just a beautiful, beautiful way to kind of craft the story. Before we start talking about some of these others, I like to talk about all of this as this big cinematic family tree that all of these films, these genres, movements, and everything are kind of under. This is one of these movements that was brought on. We've talked a little bit about its history as far as everything that's going on with World War One, or the Great War, as it was at the time. Obviously, other countries were involved in that too, but they all kind of spun off their own different things. I think in France, it was a little more of an impressionistic sort of storytelling. The Soviets had kind of created a montage style of storytelling. Any sense from either of you as far as like how everything that had gone on with the war was leading to such different types of storytelling in different parts of Europe?
What's interesting in this period is we have an art defining itself. What is its purpose? What relationship should I have with the audience? And so on. And for example, in Russia, we have everything running from someone who says narrative is bourgeois. Let's do just reality, like Bertov, or let's make it even more theatrical, or let's make it revolutionary as Eisenstein, or poetic as Dovzhenko. I mean, everybody is experimenting and they're trying to reach an audience and really have impact. You know, even in England, you know, Grierson's work with the documentary and saying this is an educational tool, we need to change our society. So in various countries, you're getting a different goal. It's not commercial as the goal was in America. It's far more serious because what's going on in the country is not being taken lightly. It's unstable. And so let's try to reach people, change people, make the world a better place. And in France, we've got people like Daly and Bunuel presenting anti-narrative, like everything is absurd in Chien d'Andailloux. So this is the 20s, and the 20s is very formative on the different branches of what film will become.
And actually, that is quite important, Ken. You're right, because crucially as well, the 20s is the time of modernity and the establishing of the city as the place of action. But that itself is both fascinating and terrifying for many observers at the time.
Yes.
The move away from the countryside, what many saw as the abandoning of traditional values. In different countries, you've still got what is effectively the late industrialization process having an impact on populations. And of course, film comes out of that. I mean, film is a technological marvel, which is bringing all of this to people who've never had the chance to see some of these images before in their lives. But I think crucially, coming back to Germany, what is almost unique to their mix is defeat. That means that the country, not only does it go into revolution as the war is coming to an end, I mean, there is open warfare on the streets of Germany even before the armistice brings the war to an end and the Kaiser is toppled. So even as you go into the Weimar period, you've got a country which is asking really fundamental questions about itself and its identity and where it wants to go next. And film is the entertainment medium of the day, which seems to be able to explore the question, if not necessarily offer all the answers. And I think that still for us today, as well as for contemporary audiences, that's part of the fascination. And that's even before, I guess, we think about what comes at the end of the period with the rise of the Nazis in 1933, which for many is the answer that people choose.
I think that's a really interesting element when you look at the darkness of the films here, as far as like you were talking about the defeat and how that kind of shifted into a thinking and, you know, where are we? Who are we? You know, how do we move on past this? And we get these stories of these people trying to kind of contend with the answers to that. You also brought up the idea of the change in society is like the city became the central point for people's lives. And that's something that we see in some of the stories, including the next one we're going to talk about, The Street, directed by Carl Grün. And I don't think we mentioned, but Cabinet of Dr. Caligari was directed by, I'm not sure the last name, is it Robert Wien or Wine or?
Wiener. Vina is how you pronounce it, yeah.
Robert Vina. The Street, directed by Carl Grün. This one I had not seen before, and watching this, I could not help but think back to Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, which has a similar feel. This one, however, is a couple. They're already living in a city. They're not farmers, but the husband clearly is bored with his life at home and decides he's going to go out on the town and ends up getting tempted and drawn into this this downfall with this woman that he encounters, and it takes him on quite a dark journey. That film, I think, it's definitely less of the internal kind of psychological exploration that we have in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is very surreal, very dark, certainly kind of pushes into the kind of the horror elements of it. This one is really kind of this just human drama of this person who's looking for something more in life, essentially, and ends up going down a very dark road. But I think it also, I mean, it very much fits into the genre still, and it's very psychological dealing with this person. And it speaks a lot for me to all of those points you were just saying, Ian, as far as the life in the city, this feeling of defeat, this feeling of like, who am I? What am I doing? And trying to figure that out. This was one of the ones that you had added to the list of films that you thought would be worth talking about. What is it about this one that stands out as far as like its place in German Expressionism?
It's regarded as being a film which launches a genre, which is always an interesting thing in itself. I mean, the street film becomes part of the Weimar Expressionist toolbox, as it were. But actually, as well, we can see already the beginnings of what becomes film noir in the US and elsewhere. This idea that we can be both attracted to and repulsed by the city in equal measure, which in a sense is not a million miles away from some of the things we're saying with Caligari or any of the other films that we'll talk about, where these conflicting associations and desires going on in the individual. I mean, one of the opening sequences in Die Straße, in The Street, beg your pardon, you're going to need to the English title.
That's fine.
One of the opening sequences in The Street shows the husband kind of lounging on his sofa and looking up at his ceiling. And there are images from the street outside flickering on the ceiling. And of course, that is a self-referential notion of the cinema already, where images flicker in front of the audience's eyes, and talks of temptation, of the deep-seated human desire to want something more, something different, something more exciting. And he follows that temptation and learns a pretty harsh lesson. And so it's just a super little film at that level. It's not one I knew until quite recently, and there aren't really very good copies of it. I think there's a new copy due out imminently. The digital restoration was premiered at the Pordenone Film Festival late in 2023, and so we're kind of waiting eagerly now for the new restored DVD with I think as well maybe even some missing sequences. But there are times, again, when some of the images in the film, he steps out onto the street, he goes on his adventure, and almost immediately passes an attractive young woman. And as he pauses, the woman's face morphs into a skull.
Right, yeah.
And you don't get that all that well at the moment with the copy we've got. But yeah, that, I think, quite a shocking moment for the man. I think it's quite a shocking moment for the audience. Because that's that sense of promise and threat combined in that one scene. And you're quite right. I mean, obviously, Murnau was working in Germany already by this time, and some of that definitely translates then all the way into Sunrise later on with that notion of, dare I say it at the time, sort of the vampish it girl who is symbolic of this period, sexual liberation, frivolity, but coupled with a fear that this means that some quite fundamental values and beliefs might be lost at the same time.
You know, if we use Caligari as an example of narrative exaggeration, here we have a more realist presentation. I would call it an early melodrama, and melodrama has always been very popular in Germany. It's the story of a powerless person trying to acquire power from whatever the power structure is, the city, you know, people who are better off, and fails and suffers the consequences. And so here we have a different kind of arc. It's in the world as you and I know it. It is urban, and the outcome, though, is dark in a similar way. But the presentation is utterly different than a film like Caligari.
That was something I found really interesting watching this one, in that it does have a much more realistic tone to it. And, you know, Ian, you had mentioned that this one is the birth of kind of the street films, another subgenre within the Weimar era of films, that there is this urban realistic world that we kind of depict in the street films. We're out in the streets, we're seeing real life of everything going on here. But there's definitely these expressionistic elements that you were talking about. And that's what I found so interesting about it, that really kind of got into the psychology of our protagonist as he goes on this incredibly dark journey. And that image of the woman turning into her face turning into a skull, like that really spoke to me of like the way that they were using the German expressionistic stylings to kind of craft this story and get us into this person's journey. And it made for an interesting exploration and really kind of this crossing of these two subgenres or kind of in the German expressionistic movement. This was something that kind of squeezed into that in an interesting way. And I found just a really kind of fascinating exploration of his psychology here. Speaking of these other films that kind of a whole variety of these different types of films, we should just mention there are a few other films that came out of my German is obviously not the strongest, but is it the Weimar era or Weimar? Am I saying it wrong?
Yes, it's a V sound at the beginning of the name. Yeah.
It's a V. Okay. Yeah, Weimar. Gotcha. So this Weimar period of cinema, there's the street films. We also have mountain films. We're going to talk about a film that fits into that subgenre in our member bonus content. You know, there were also some like chamber dramas and a number of other different types of stories that were all told in this era. And a lot of them do dabble in kind of the German expressionistic story and this world. The next film that we have is one that, you know, a number of these I had seen back in film school. F.W. Murnau's The Last Laugh was one of them, or The Last Man, depending on the title and how you're going to...
Yeah, it's an interesting mistranslation, isn't it?
Yeah, right. I always found that to be strange. Mm. But it's a film that, again, not as necessarily stylistically expressionistic, like with the painted sets and everything. It feels a little more real world, kind of like we have in The Street. We're following a man who works as a doorman at a very fancy hotel. Because of that, seems to be generally well respected in his community. Everybody looks up to this man, but he's also aging. And when his boss sees him struggling after carrying a heavy suitcase, demotes him essentially to working in the bathroom. He's broken. Like that to him is pushing him past a point where he just no longer, like his identity was so core to his career. Like that was such a part of who he was that everything about him breaks. Like he carries himself differently. He's horribly embarrassed to even tell anybody about this. Doesn't want anybody to see him, to the point where he sneaks in after hours to steal his outfit and continue wearing it home just so people know, oh yeah, he's still as great as he was. And then when people actually discover this, it's just like it really breaks everybody. And you know, everybody shuns him, he's totally broken. And then the film gives us what I found to be such a strange shift at the end of it, because suddenly it's like the filmmakers, I'm not sure if they felt bad for him, if they felt they wanted to give us the happy ending or exactly where it is. But it seems like somebody higher than Murnau was just like, we want a happy ending here. We can't end with, you know, his downfall essentially. And it feels very tacked on to the point where it literally is tacked on. We've got an intertitle saying, oh, you know what, but let's give him something a little more happy to end the story with. And we see him actually having his happy ending. I mean, The Last Laugh is a very prominent film in this movement. What is it about this film that stands out?
Well, I think many critics consider it the perfect Weimar silent film. Murnau had claimed even before shooting this that he wanted to reach the point where silent film would not need intertitles. And apart from the fact that we have a couple of letters and newspaper articles shot in close-up to act as intertitles, that there is actually no reported speech in the intertitle. So in one sense, he achieves this. He and his cameraman, Karl Freund, I think, isn't it? they innovate, not necessarily for the very first time, but the first time with real impact with this unchained camera, where the camera is kind of put on pulleys to represent sound coming out of trumpets and things. The camera's put into the basket of a bicycle for the long shot through the hotel lobby, which establishes this not just the place of work for the porter, but as you say, the place which conveys his status upon him. And this builds on a long tradition in German literature as well about clothes making the man. And of course, a very militaristic tradition where his uniform is deliberately quite martial in its outlook. And some critics now see the whole film doubling up, not just as a film about this one man's fall from grace, from his standing in his society, but also as a reflection on capitalist principles. Modernity, of course, is very much about a fascination with the US, Fordian principles of production, and the idea that you would retire a gentleman for the heinous crime of getting too old to do his job. And so the film can be seen, especially then, yes, as you say, this really awkward tacked on ending can be seen as the beginnings of US loans. You know, this is still a period where Germany is dogged by huge economic problems, which are only solved by American loans. And so the happy ending can be seen, in fact, as not just the one man, but as Germany being rehabilitated in the post-war period by America extending a hand of friendship and, of course, then huge amounts of financial aid to help the country get back on its feet. So it works really nicely at both those levels. But it's also just more now at his creative best. It's all studio shot, experimenting with forced perspectives, with all the, you know, the huge skyscrapers and the cars scurrying by in the background, all done with little cardboard cutouts and things. But it's also a very intimate film about this one man and his fall from grace. So it works brilliantly on a number of levels.
Ken, where does this one stand for you as far as like the way that it fits into German expressionism?
Very high, particularly two things. One is highlighting a performer whose stature only will grow through this period, Jannings. And he's a great, great actor, and the performance is remarkable. In a way, you know, going to Blue Angel and so on, we see the range of this man. And he made an American film called The Last Command. Brilliant, brilliant level of performance. The other thing that is very important to me is more now I associate with the moving camera. The subjective movement, objective movement, but more the subjective movement. We're following somebody. We're seeing what they see. The subjectivity is very compelling and is really, you know, when we look at a line into modernity, the subjective camera goes from Murnau all the way to someone like Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg and Roman Polanski all embrace the camera the way that Murnau does. You know, I can't exaggerate in a way his importance on film and visualization strategies. And were it not for his early death late in the decade, we would have seen many things from this man. He's a remarkable talent.
It's amazing to look at these films and just feel how alive they are. And, you know, that's what's, I was really taken by Murnau's films. You know, I've seen a few others like Nosferatu and Faust, and already mentioned, Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. In all of them, you can just see a person who is like really playing with the tools in ways to bring the story to life. I think it was Faust where there's a moment where I think it's the woman who screams, but it's like you get this shot of her face and it's like moving across this landscape. Like it's a composite image of moving across the landscape all the way, like her, and then coming to him standing on a mountaintop or something. Yeah. And it's just like this incredible, like, I'm like, what, where did that come from? Yeah. Like, it's just, it's mind boggling. And The Last Laugh has these too. Like you talked about that bicycle shot, like, moving through the space in the hotel and just like giving us this sense. I mean, it's a totally different context, but it still gives us this sense of like this bustling life that he's capturing with the movement and the way that he's crafting the story. And I think that was in the word expressionist, I feel like that became like the movements and becomes a really key part of how do you kind of use the tools that you have at your disposal to build this emotion into this static screen that we're staring at, you know? And I think that's what, for me, was really exciting about revisiting The Last Laugh. And I'm glad you also brought up Yawnings, because I was very taken with him. I already talked a little bit about how he completely changes his posture and everything, but he really changes it. Like, he goes from this imposing tall figure of a man when he's in his uniform to something more akin to like the vampire in Nosferatu. Like, he's all hunched over and like a broken figure once he is demoted and sent down to the washroom. And going from this, and then we'll talk about in our member bonus content, The Blue Angel, that exploration of an actor who came to largely kind of be so key to the movement. I think that's something that is exciting to see here. And we have a few familiar faces that we see across these, and it's nice to see them being so elemental to the stories they're telling.
Yeah, it was an industry which was quite tight-knit in those early days. Kai Meyer calls it, although UFA was not the only studio involved in making these films, it's the one which we've come to kind of consider synonymous with the period. And Klaus Kai Meyer calls it UFA's magical kitchen, where all these different elements of acting talent, of fabulously inventive cameramen, of script writers, and of course of directors, it just all comes together. They created these units that stayed together, spent lots of time together talking about the films they were making. And to be able to eavesdrop on those conversations now, you know, that would be an amazing thing to do, just to see this creativity in action before they then go back to the studio the next day and actually film these things.
Yeah. The stories so far, they've largely been stories of men that we're kind of watching them as they go through as our protagonists. The next film that we have on the list is Pandora's Box from 1929 that G.W. Pabst directed. This film, we have a female protagonist here, and it also kind of fits into that world of, you know, this modern society and this liberated woman who... she's very excited by a lot of the stuff going on, but also drawn in to essentially her own Pandora's box. And that's the story that we kind of watch her take this journey that takes her deeper and deeper down into troubles and problems by wanting to kind of, you know, experience, enjoy life. She kind of essentially goes all the way down to the bottom until eventually she ends up a victim of Jack the Ripper, which was quite a surprise. I didn't see that one coming.
No.
Yeah. That was a really interesting one. I hadn't seen this one before. This is one that I had heard of a lot. A lot of it is because Louise Brooks, that look, that incredibly just perfect look when we see her, and she's got that iconic image that we think of with the 20s and the kind of the flapper era and everything like that, I think just spoke to why this film may be something that people recognize if they haven't seen it before. What is it about this one that kind of ties into all of this?
Yeah, that the film historian and critic Lotta Eisner talks about the miracle of Louise Brooks in this film. And there is at least an apocryphal story that Pabst held up shooting until he found the right actress and discovered Brooks still in the States at that point, and invited her over specifically to play this role. And she did some more work with Pabst, but then went back to the States. I mean, the film is almost unimaginable without her.
Yeah, right.
This idea of her encapsulating this moment in time where modernity has allowed women a degree of freedom which they've never enjoyed before. They can express themselves sexually. They can, to a certain extent, be independent. but then in the film coupled still with a kind of a patriarchal system that may not be entirely okay with this after all. That's the, you know, the notion of the Greek tragedy is once you open the box, you can't put things back in the box. And you unleash this, the character Lulu, you unleash this sexual force. And the men in the film, and one would suggest from interpreting the film, the men watching the film desire her, but they also fear her. She's another kind of vampire like Nosferatu. You might get your pleasure from your encounter with her, but that pleasure is going to be pretty ruinous. It makes for a great film. Perhaps was a much more socially aware director than probably the other major directors this period. He seems to be keeping an eye on social trends more than some of the others, and is exploring this tension. You know, in academic circles, we talk about the virgin vamp dichotomy in Weimar film, where a woman can be both liberated and sexually attractive and wanted, but also then punished for encapsulating those things as well. At a time when society is debating where it's going, what are these values that we want to uphold as we go forward?
And that's definitely going to be an interesting thing to kind of continue in our conversation in the member bonus content when we talk about different from the others, because that one's mm-hmm. definitely dealing homosexuality in a very open way. So a lot of these things that the society is sorting out at this particular point in time. Ken, as far as kind of like these themes of sexuality and social norms, you know, what's your impression of this one?
Well, I mean, it's a remarkable movie, and Brooks, of course, is at its heart. But just picking up the issue of yawnings and switching over to women, Joyless Street earlier with Garbo, this film with Brooks, Blue Angel with Marlene Dietrich, there is an arc of sexualized women, desirable women in these works. And in terms of Pandora's Box, I would add that there's a dimension to the performance and to the use of light, which to me is a kind of an uninhibited libido, sexuality, and it needs to be punished to be reined in. So here we've got this explosive sexualization of this woman, a remarkable performance, and the use of light to energize this ball of fire. And I think it's a tragedy when Jack the Ripper comes into it, because that's the only force that can rein in the sexual power and desire of Lulu. You know, this is a character from Wedekind, his play. Transgression in society is what, you know, Lulu represents and needs to be contained in the way it is, tragically. But it is an energy that captivates all the men in it. So it, to me, there's an affiliation to a psychoanalysis. There's an affiliation to stardom, which all these women represented well into the 40s. So it's a kind of, it's a force of nature, and what do you do with it? You know, in Ninotchka, Lubitsch said it in communist terms, but liberated that sensuality. Here we have the tragic end to that sensuality. And anyway, it's remarkable, remarkable work.
But it's an interesting ending, because by the time we get to that final scene where Lulu ends up with Jack, it's her sympathy and her kindness that wins him over. And essentially almost keeps him from actually killing her. And it was like such an interesting way to play that, because it's kind of breaking with that idea of her sexuality and everything. It's just like there is this actual human connection that keeps him from doing anything. And it's only the fact that there is that knife lying on the counter that kind of pushes him over the edge eventually.
Yeah, we explore with our students that ending, because it's the only time that Lulu engages in a relationship which is not transactional.
Yeah.
You know, although she's not a prostitute as such, earlier in the film, she's a kept woman and various men are vying for her final attention. And actually, Jack the Ripper says he hasn't got any money, because by then she's been forced into prostitution. And for the first time, she's clearly attracted him just for the man he is.
Yeah.
And lets her guard down. And that's the moment when she's punished, which is really quite interesting in its own right.
Well, it makes it all the more tragic, really. You know, she finally breaks away from that, and it still doesn't help. Which, you know, speaking of stories of crime, the final film that we're talking about, you know, Ken, you had already introduced this one, Fritz Lang's M, as the story of pedophilia and this nature that we're kind of exploring a serial killer's psychology in this film. And what this is a film that I've long loved, just kind of the way that Lang tells it, and it really kind of becomes this procedural film following the police as they're trying to figure out what's going on. But also, and this is what I find so exciting about the film, is the criminal underworld also, they get tired of the police hounding them, and so they decide they're going to do it themselves, and they want to figure out who this is. And then we get this whole tale of the criminal underworld trying to figure out who it is, and they eventually do. And it's fantastic film. It very much fits into the work that Lang was doing, but also feels very expressionistic. And something we haven't talked about is the introduction of sound that by this point, 1931, I believe, with this film, that we're getting the sound, the iconic whistling of Peter Lorre when he's sees the kids and is interested. Ken, as far as like this story, the way that it's told, and then the introduction of sound. And of course, this is also kind of like the end of that Weimar era, as then we shift into Hitler and everything. How does this kind of tie into everything that we've been talking about with expressionism and the breaking point away from it as Germany shifts beyond it?
The use of sound is pretty inhibited by a noisy camera for a few years. And it's only a few adventurous filmmakers that break away from the static camera and simply a staged view of someone talking or singing. So we've got Mamoulian with applause and with Jekyll and Hyde in the 32. And then we've got this film. And in each case, they're using sound as either a transitional device or a device to affiliate. So, for example, in dialogue sequences, he'll cut between the criminals and the police, and they will continue the dialogue. But the consequence of that is Lang saying to us, is there really any difference between the police and the criminals? In other places, it's used kind of emotionally. When the mother, for example, of the girl who's killed is calling out her name, she keeps calling, and the sound, the tone is very loud, prominent, and it keeps receding until it's almost a whisper. And the consequence of that is the mother is losing her daughter, both, you know, metaphorically and physically, because that last is, she's now been killed by the pedophile. So sound is kind of used far more freely by Lang and Mamoulian. That sort of liberates and transitions to the sound era that's less contained by technical, you know, limitations. So creatively, these filmmakers like Lang have used sound in a much more liberated and effective narrative fashion. I would say that's one of the great things about the use of sound in this film. The other thing that I would say, which goes to Krakauer's interpretation of this, which is that the police are ineffective in this film, and it requires the criminals to reestablish order in the society and justice against the murderer in a way that more societal observation, is saying, hey, we're going down a rabbit hole, folks. Law and order ain't going to do it for you. So it's a powerful idea. And, one can carry that forward as perhaps we're about to enter a new era. The last thing I would say about this is the performance of Peter Lorre is astonishing. And like Jannings, like Garbo, like Dietrich, everyone gravitates towards American cinema eventually. And Lorre had a pretty interesting career in America post facto. But what also has to be said is that some of these people left because the Nazis were anti-Jewish. And, people like Lorre and Ulmer and Siodmak, all these people left Germany. So we in effect get a transfer of talent to the benefit of Hollywood and the detriment of German cinema, although German cinema enters then the age of Leni Riefenstahl, and it's a different kind of power.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting, talking again about the expressionistic heritage of this period, I mean, although films have slowly but surely shifted into a much more realistic mode of representation as the decade has progressed, thematically and to a certain extent visually, the films never seem to lose sight of those roots of exploring the human condition. And M, of course, is a very uncomfortable exploration of the human condition with, as Ken said, Peter Lorre giving this masterful performance of a man obsessed with something which society doesn't approve of, but obsessed nevertheless. And Lang harnesses so much of the experience of that previous decade in terms of storytelling and in terms of visualization to represent this mania, which causes panic in society. So you've got all the same themes. What kind of society do you want? What kind of society have you got? Where is the sense of community in the modern world? People who, for all kinds of reasons, have descended into what we would call madness, and bringing that to a screen in a way which almost one film after the other takes the medium a step forward means that they just become marvelous. Whether you watch them in chronological order, whether you watch them thematically, they speak to each other in ways which just surprise even now.
And Peter Lorre is very familiar face. I mean, I feel like as a kid, I probably first saw him in like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And then as you kind of like grow older and you start looking into film, you start seeing all of these other sorts of films that he's been in, and very just prominent actor who's just got such an iconic face and that voice and everything. And it's so fun seeing him pop up in things like Casablanca, but yeah, he's been in plenty of horrors. And of course, Hitchcock used him in a film shortly after this with The Man Who Knew Too Much. Just so iconic. And it's such a, like you said, both of you have said, like this psychological exploration of this character, this and this type of character. Like, there's probably other moments like this in film, but like the next one that really stands out in my head is like going to something like Little Children with Jackie Earle Haley. Like, you're really kind of jumping into the psychology of a person who has this compulsion and can't hold back. And it's horrifying. And by the time we have that final sequence with him after he's been captured, it's a pretty terrifying glimpse into the psychology of this man. Ken, you talked a little bit about how from this point with the rise of Hitler and the Nazis and Leni Riefenstahl kind of starting to do all of the films that she'll be making in the Nazi era, a lot of these filmmakers left. Fritz Lang comes over and starts making films in Hollywood. A lot of these other filmmakers do. As we start kind of closing our conversation and wrapping up, I want to talk a little bit about how it evolved from this point. Again, a lot of these filmmakers came over here, continued a lot of these stories, which really kind of helped to birth film noir. But so many other films and styles and filmmakers have taken from German Expressionism and used it to kind of craft the stories that they tell. As far as like the journey of Expressionism, what has it gone on to influence and where can we see its impact? I know that's a big question. It's like, where can't you?
It is a big question because, I mean, at one level, it might seem a bit oversimplistic, but I would almost say you can see the influence this period in every national cinema, however we might define that these days, in every period of cinema which follows, the degree of innovation.
As we start wrapping up, I would love to know from both of you, you know, we've talked about these five films. We're going to talk about five additional films shortly in our member bonus content. We'll talk about different from the others, The Holy Mountain, Asphalt, People on Sunday, and The Blue Angel. Outside of that, if people are interested in kind of exploring some more in the world of German Expressionism, do either of you have any films that you would recommend people also check out?
I think Variety by DuPont is well worth seeing if you can see it. It's very powerful, pretty sophisticated technically. That's a pretty interesting movie.
And, you know, your point about that was, you know, well taken. A lot of these films are harder to track down. And sometimes the prints aren't great, like The Street, for example. Ian, you mentioned that that one is hopefully being worked on in a restoration. But, you know, Ken and I had to watch a not so great YouTube copy of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where a number of these end up is like, hey, at least it's out there, though. It's accessible, you know. Ian, what about you? Any other films that you would recommend?
Well, my specialist area of research is Murnau, so I would say anything by Murnau. But if I step away from Murnau for a second, because you know, Faust, Nosferatu, yeah. Sunrise, just for the sheer fun of it, I love Fritz Lang's Woman in the Moon from 1929. It's one of my secret favorites, just for the sheer joy of cinema in the period. Lang was a real rocket nut anyway. Great technical effects. I mean, some effects where I think still film scholars are not entirely sure how some of them were achieved. But science fiction, which is not that common in the period, science fiction nevertheless, which explores very, very human emotions again, you know, love and hatred and loyalty and deceit. It's just a fun film. And I think that's what it boils down to. When I first came to Weimar film, it was almost out of a sense of duty that it's a period I ought to know about. And then I just fell head over heels in love with the films. And sometimes it's just good to enjoy the films.
Yeah.
So yeah, that would be my kind of my hidden tip.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, definitely. I haven't seen either of those, so I've added two more to my list. I'm very much looking forward to checking those out because, yeah, re-exploring these films and this movement, it's just ignited my passion into watching them because it's so exciting to see what these filmmakers were doing 100 years ago, you know, yeah. With the tools they had. I mean, it's just amazing to watch the films. And I mean, the color, the hand tinted look that they've crafted with it. I mean, it's just, they're beautiful, beautiful, exciting films to watch. Well, both of you, thank you so much for joining me here today. Ken, I know you ran into some internet issues, but I'm glad you were able to continue the conversation with us. Do either of you have any books that you would recommend or anything that you would want to direct people to check out?
Ken mentioned Krakauer's From Caligari to Hitler, and that it went through a period. It was written in 1947. And Krakauer was an exile from Germany. He'd been a film critic and a philosopher in Berlin in the 20s. So he has an agenda in the immediate post-war period. But the title itself, From Caligari to Hitler, it is a great study of how film can be used as a cultural artifact to try to understand better this fascinating period and how Germany ends up sliding into totalitarianism. I am working on a monograph of Murnau at the moment. That's kind of what I would hope to be the final publication of my career, really. But back in 2008 now, I published a short volume called German Expressionist Cinema, The World of Light and Shadow, published by Wallflower Press. I think it's since been picked up by Columbia University Press, I'm not sure. And I wrote it in the first instance as a guide and an introduction for people who were perhaps trying to find their way into the topic when they knew little or nothing about the period. I recommend it to my students, and they often say they find it very illuminating. And again, I hope at least, I mean, I had great fun writing it about films that I love. So I hope, and I've had some feedback from people very kindly saying that they found it fun to read as well as kind of a gateway publication. So I guess I would recommend that.
Excellent. Well, I'll make sure I put a link for it in the show notes.
So. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Ken, how about yourself?
Well, most of what I've written is about storytelling. The dry titled technique of film and video editing, which I'm about to do an eighth edition of, is not that dry because it's the history of editing. And but I was stuck with a title that Carl Reis and Gavin Miller used called The Technique of Film Editing, which went into the 50s in publication, although it's been republished more recently. I also would recommend something that I didn't write, but that I find very useful as a continuum. There's a cinematographer named John Alton who wrote Master of Light. And it's really all the lighting techniques that developed in the Expressionist period he exercised as a cinematographer and then wrote this book about it. But his films are very reminiscent the way they're lit to the Expressionist period. He's really an interesting guy.
Yeah, and that was a book that I had from film school, Painting with Light, I think is what it's called. Light. It's very interesting, beautiful work that John Alton does. So I'll make sure I have all links for all of these in the show notes. So, well, both of you, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. It's been a wonderful conversation with the two of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And before we close, members, don't forget about our special bonus content. We're going to be taking a look at 5 more German Expressionist films to further deepen our understanding of this groundbreaking movement. If you're not yet a member, but you're interested in joining us on this extended exploration, visit thenextreel.com/membership to access the exclusive content. Next month, we will be diving into the wild and wacky world of Ozploitation. We'll explore how this uniquely Australian subgenre burst onto the scene in the 70s and 80s, delivering a heady mix of action, horror, and comedy that gleefully pushed the boundaries of good taste. From high-octane thrills to gory delights, we'll discover how Ozploitation put Australian cinema on the map and left an indelible mark on pop culture. So buckle up and join us as we take a white-knuckle ride through the irreverent, audacious, and utterly unforgettable films that defined this one-of-a-kind movement. Thank you for joining us on CinemaScope, part of the True Story FM Entertainment Podcast Network. The music is Junkie Monkey by Orcas and Class Act by Adrian Berenguer. You can find our show and the entire The Next Reel family of film podcasts at truestory.fm. We'd love for you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Letterboxd at The Next Reel. We greatly appreciate your ratings and reviews, so if your podcast app allows it, please let us know how we're doing. And as we part ways, remember your cinematic journey never ends. Stay curious.
I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms. But in August 2022, we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM. And it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
and their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.